Studies which recently found that a number of our devotees passed away. Online you have an obituary section, right, where they list people that died. And it shows the list of deceased people who are being fondly remembered by their relatives. And so often it's interesting to note that each departed soul, they usually say, well, he or she has gone to heaven. Right? That's the phrase. Is now resting in the arms of God. And as a devotee, it's quite interesting to note that when you read in these obituaries, they're saying, you know, this man that was formerly a butcher or a nonsense sort of person, and he's now resting in the arms of God. He's in heaven now. And although through modern atheistic teachings and education in today's society, education is atheistic, and teaches nothing about life after death or where we're going, or there's no information whatsoever about the consequence of our passing. And yet, surprising, people still have faith or some sort of an idea that, well, my loved one has passed away, he or she must be now in heaven, resting in the arms of God. And so this is quite a wonder for devotees, because we see, how can a person who's lived a life of sinful activities go to heaven at one point? Just because we feel sentimentally involved or sentimentally attached, that doesn't mean necessarily they're going to heaven. What if there's a criminal or a butcher or someone like that? Will they still go to heaven? So this section that we're reading about, the last couple of verses, is describing this heavenly environment. And it's the abode of Lord Shiva. And even it's described that it's almost like Vaikuntha. Almost like Vaikuntha. It's very, very beautiful. So in the Srimad Bhagavatam, in Canto 5, we can read about the lower heavenly planets, because not only are there heavenly planets going right up to the abode of Lord Shiva, but there's also the subterranean heavenly planets. Does anybody know about subterranean heavenly planets? Subterranean heavenly planets are even more desirable than the heavenly planets. And so I wanted to just read out the wonderful things that you can experience if you want to go to the subterranean heavenly planets. So this is from the fifth canto, and it's addressing a king. Dear king, beneath this earth are seven other planets known as Atala, Vitala, Sutala, Talatala, and Mahatala, Rakshatala, and Patala. In these seven planetary systems, which are known as subterranean heavenly planets, there are very beautiful houses, gardens, places of sense enjoyment, which are even more opulent than those of the higher planetary systems, because the demons have a very high standard of sensual pleasure. So in the heavenly planets, there's a little bit of austerity in the heavenly planets, although beautiful gardens and everything. Yes, this is beautiful. But in the subterranean heavenly planets, the demons are actually thinking, hey, that we really want to enjoy it. So, there is very high standards of sensual pleasure, wealth and influence. Most of the residents of these planets are known as daityas. Dhanavas and Nagas live as householders, their wives and children and family and society fully engaged in illusory material happiness. The sense enjoyment of the demigods is sometimes disturbed. But the residents of these planets enjoy life without disturbance. Thus they are understood to be very attached to illusory happiness. My dear king, in the imitation heaven, known as Bilavasvarga, there is a great demon known as Maha Dhanava. Anybody heard of Maya Dhanava? Maya Dhanava, who is an expert artist and architect. He constructed many brilliantly decorated cities, and there are many wonderful houses, walls, gates, assembly houses, temple yards, temple compounds, as well as many hotels serving as residential quarters for foreigners, if you just happen to be passing through the subterranean heavenly planets. The houses for the leaders of these planets are constructed with the most valuable jewels. They are always crowded with living entities known as Nagas and Asuras, as well as many pigeons, parrots and similar birds. All in all, these imitation heavenly cities are most beautifully situated and attractively decorated. The parks and gardens in the artificial heavens surpass in beauty those of the upper heavenly planets. The trees in those gardens, embraced by creepers, bend with the heavy burden of twigs and fruits and flowers, and therefore they appear extraordinarily beautiful. That beauty could attract anyone and make his mind fully blossom in pleasure of sense gratification. There are many lakes and reservoirs with clear, transparent water, agitated by jumping fish, and decorated with many flowers such as lilies and blue and red lotuses. Pairs of chakrabakas and many other water birds nest in the lakes and always enjoy in a happy mood, making sweet, pleasant vibrations that are very pleasing and conducive to the enjoyment of the senses. Since there is no sunlight on these subterranean heavenly planets, time is not divided into days and nights, and consequently, fear produced by time does not exist. Interesting, isn't it? Many red serpents reside there with gems on their hoods, and the effulgence of these gems dissipate the darkness in all directions. Since the residents of these planets drink and bathe in juices and elixirs made from wonderful herbs, they are free from anxieties and physical diseases. They have no experience of grey hairs, wrinkles, or invalidity, and their bodily lustre does not fade. Their perspiration does not cause a bad smell, and they have no trouble, and they are not troubled by fatigue or lack of energy or enthusiasm due to old age. Sounding good, this is a pretty good advertisement, isn't it? My dear King, now I shall describe to you the lower planetary systems one by one, beginning from Atala. In Atala there is a demon known as Mayadandha, named Bala, who created 96 kinds of mystic powers. So this Bala created these mystic powers. So-called yogis and swamis take advantage of this mystic power to achieve people even today. So you have some of these mystics and gurus that present themselves in the Western world, and they sometimes have mystic powers. They can produce some ash, or they can produce some gold, or they can see into the future, and they can read the mind, or something like that. So they're actually coming from the lower planetary systems, this power. If a man enters the planet of Atala, the women immediately capture him and induce him to drink an intoxicating beverage made with a drug known as pataka. Heard of pataka? Commonly called marijuana here in Australia. This intoxicant endows the man with great sexual prowess, of which the women take advantage for enjoyment. A woman will enchant him with attractive glances, imitate intimate words, smiles of love, and then embraces. In this way, she induces him to enjoy sex with her to her full satisfaction. Because of his increased sexual power, the man thinks himself stronger than 10,000 elephants and considers himself the most perfect. Indeed, illusioned and intoxicated by false pride, he thinks himself God, ignoring impending death. So this is really... So we have the description here of Lord Shiva's abode, and now down below as well. So I want to just read the next verse, Prabhupada's given, because it's a very interesting verse and it's very pertinent for us to hear these things. In the next verse, I'll just read the translation. In the next verse, Srila Prabhupada says, or the verse is, all these atmospheric influences unsettle the forest elephants who flock together in the Sandalwood forest. And the blowing wind agitated the minds of the damsels there for further sexual enjoyment. So there's this sexual enjoyment down below in the lower heavenly planets, and there's this sexual enjoyment right up in the heavenly planets, right up to the high region where Lord Shiva resides. So Prabhupada's purport is in here. Whenever there is a nice atmosphere in the material world, immediately there is an awakening of the sexual appetite in the minds of materialistic persons. This tendency is presented everywhere within the material world, not only on this earth, but in the higher planetary systems as well. In complete contrast with the influence of this atmosphere on the minds of living entities within this material world is the description of the spiritual world. The women there are hundreds and thousands of times more beautiful than the women here in the material world, as is the men. The men are more beautiful, more handsome than anything in this material world. And the spiritual atmosphere is almost is also many times better. Yet despite the pleasing atmosphere, the minds of the denizens do not become agitated, because in the spiritual world, the Vaikuntha planets, the spiritualistic minds of the inhabitants are much more absorbed in spiritual vibration of chanting the glories of the Lord, that such enjoyment could not surpass by any other enjoyment, even sex life, which is the culmination of all pleasure in the material world. Sex life is the pleasure that everybody strives for, in all different forms of life. Some people actually told me one time, I was doing some drug rehabilitation programs, and someone said, you know, actually taking heroin is more enjoyable than sex life. And I said, well, what about if you have sex when you're on heroin? He said, yeah, well, that's the best. So sex life is still the best. So they say. So the Lord has said, where was I? Even sex, which is the culmination of all pleasure in this material world. In other words, in the Vaikuntha world, in spite of its being a better atmosphere and our facilities, there is no impetus for sex life. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita 2.59, Param Drishtam Niravartam Te. The inhabitants are so spiritually enlightened that in the presence of such a spirituality, sex life is insignificant. So this is a really interesting word. So in other words, in the Vaikuntha world, in spite of it being a better atmosphere, conducive, there is no impetus for sex life. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita, Param Drishtam Niravartam Te. Inhabitants of Vaikuntha are so spiritually enlightened that in the presence of such spirituality, sex life is insignificant. So if you said that to a materialist in this, in our lives, sex life is insignificant, that would go to be crazy. Because for a materialist, sex life is everything. Whether it's gross sex life or subtle sex life, it is still totally engaging. Ultimately, both the higher, we're reading here from the higher, and we've read from the lower, subterranean heavenly planets, sex life, and in between, which is where we are, we're in between both the higher and the lower, the overriding influence to trap an individual in this material world is this sex life. We used to do a play, some of you may have seen it recently, and back 30 years ago we had a play about Hansel and Gretel. And I was reminded of it because Basu Shrestha Prabhu was here the other day, and we showed this play to some of our younger devotees, and he was the guru, and they recognized his voice from the play. Anyway, in the play, the house, it depicts Hansel, you know the story of Hansel and Gretel, right? And how they are enchanted by the witch, and she had a house made of gingerbread. So the whole analogy behind this play was that gingerbread was sex life. And Hansel and Gretel were somehow or other wanting to get more and more gingerbread. Anyway, in the end they realized it was all futile and there was no reason to be engaged, and the higher taste was there, and they left to go to the spiritual world. So the only way to get out of this captivating thing called sex attraction is to be completely absorbed in devotional service. That's being pointed out here by Srila Prabhupada. That's the criteria in the Vaikuntha planets. That's the criteria of a person wanting to escape this material world. And we have to, you know, we have to really make an effort. So if we are still shackled by the sex desire, we must analyze why. Now, you're not alone. Some people think, okay, oh God, I'm so afflicted by sexual desires. What the hell is wrong with me? You're not alone. Every single person on this planet is having some form of push or pull from sexual desire. There's a really interesting incident where Srila Prabhupada was left alone with an elderly, not so good-looking old lady in a room. The devotees left him, but in a very early time. They left him in this room with an elderly lady. And when the lady left and the devotees came back into the room, Prabhupada chastised the devotees severely. How could you leave me with a woman alone? I'm a sannyasi. I could have fallen down. This is Srila Prabhupada, showing the example that we have to be really mindful. So, if we're somehow still afflicted and disturbed by sexual agitation, we have to ask ourselves, has devotional service, have I been practicing correctly? Am I getting joy out of devotional service? Because the truth is that this sex life is just a brief, fleeting bit of enjoyment, a little bit of bliss, a little spontaneous little bit of bliss. And we need to actually curb that to achieve the higher spiritual understanding. So if we are struggling with that, it is imperative that we seek counselling. So this is something that devotees are very reluctant to do, because they think, actually, I'm the only one that's having this problem as far as sexual relationships or sexual desire is concerned. All the other ones are all pure devotees, but I'm the only formal one. Where in actuality, we're all struggling in different ways. So if you are, you have to support, you have to seek counselling and support. It is imperative, it is presented in the Shastra, that a person has to reveal one's mind in order to grow. Rupa Goswami says that we have to reveal our mind to another devotee. We have to let it out and make it clear to people of what your current situation is. So if you're having a problem, you have to seek support and counselling from a comforting, confidential, and a devotee that will support you, senior devotee, that you trust. So you find someone that you can trust with your secret, and you tell them. And by telling them your secret, by opening up, that actually starts to alleviate the problem. And seek assistance and reveal your mind. Don't bottle it up. That's my advice to devotees. Please don't bottle up these different hankerings and frustrations that you have. It is better that you reveal them and get counselling and support for it. The worst thing you can do, because what happens is if you bottle this up and think, I'm the only one, I'm so fallen, I can't, then what happens is it will lead to stress, it will lead to self-doubt, it will lead to really frustration, to the extent where you can even get to a stage where you're so damaged. And we've seen it in devotional service where people actually do pretty horrific sort of things, either leave Krishna consciousness or they do something even more drastic psychologically. So it's really important that if in a humble, honest way, just to present to someone that you trust, and the person that you trust will take your direction in confidence. They won't hold it against you because they probably have had to go through the same thing. And then a person will help you through that. And then through counselling and direction and different programs, a devotee can then again attain a taste in devotional service and the chanting and hearing of the Lord to actually make progress and counter this. So we see from the Shastras that heaven and hell do exist. Even right here on this earth we see there's heaven and hell. It's not that hard to explain. You know, we're all happiness seekers, and the real happiness to be found is spiritual happiness, but even that, so there is a heaven and a hell here on earth. So, as I said, the sex life is a momentary flash of bliss. Once you have conquered that desire, then you go back and back to Godhead. Now, there's an interesting saying in Krishna consciousness. If you ever know about the little blue boy that's playing his flute on the banks of the Jamuna, if you go to him, you'll never ever be the same again. Mm-hmm. Right? So this is it. If you turn to Krishna, he will always help you. And there's no going back. Once you've had just the slightest experience of Krishna's love, of Krishna's connection, of your connection to Krishna, you get a little taste, like in the early days. And Krishna is such a tricky fellow. In the early days of Krishna consciousness, when you first come and a devotee has encouraged you to start chanting, and you chant, and you think, wow, this is really fantastic. And it's so exuberant, so uplifting. I remember when we first came to Krishna consciousness, we couldn't stop chanting. We had competitions between each other, how many rounds we could chant. We would chant 32 rounds, 64 rounds, you know. And to this day, I still remember the first really ecstatic experience of chanting. We were much the same as what's described here. I was sitting on a grass area with a beautiful river flowing past, the trees and the birds were singing and everything. And I was chanting so sincerely, and there was a welling up of ecstasy that I've never ever experienced in any other way. It was so pure and so beautiful that in those early days I thought, I'm going to get me some more of that. And that's the thing. So as soon as you see that little blue boy, as soon as you make contact, there's never ever going any back. Even we have sometimes that devotees, they leave Krishna consciousness due to frustration, due to this sexual desire, due to frustrations and different things. And they try hard to again enjoy the material world. You know some friends perhaps that have done that, that are sort of ex-devotees, they're out there and they're trying so hard to enjoy it. But they always know there is that little blue boy that offers more enjoyment than whatever you can get out there in the material world. And it's really sad to see that. So modern scientists would have us believe that there is no heaven or hell. You know, that it's actually just a mythical concept. It's something that has been concocted to somehow or other propagate people to live better lives. You know, well, if you don't go, you'll go to hell or heaven. So they say there's no such thing. However, when the scientists are asked to explain the nature and cause of this unlimited universe and its diversities, they fail to provide satisfactory answers. They can't figure it out. It's quite reasonable to believe in the existence of heaven and hell within this universe, and as I said, because heaven and hell exist here, right here. You can see it on the news every night. You can either go to Las Vegas or LA or the Gold Coast, and there's so much beauty there. You can walk through a park with it, and in the same token, you can go to the slums of South Africa where Indradumna Maharaj is at the moment, preaching Krishna consciousness, and see the most degraded and horrible situation where people live. So there's heaven and hell everywhere. So there should not be. So why should there be a disparity and not exist in the universal construction? In the universe, there are heaven and hellish places. The Vedic scriptures give us a detailed account of all the other planets, as was mentioned, including the heavens. And they tell us that there are 14 levels of planetary systems, as explained. And there are magnificent palaces and huge gardens and wonderful, just as being described here. There's Gandharvas, celestial beings that sing and dance. If we think that the singing and everything is beautiful here, when you hear a Gandharva sing, it's just like the hairs on your body stand up, and it's the most beautiful thing. There are pleasures in the paradises of Indraloka, where Lord Indra resides. One goes further, beyond Indraloka, into the celestial realms. The senses of their objects become more subtle, and the quality of sense enjoyment becomes greatly enhanced. In contrast to those heavenly planets, sense enjoyment on the planet Earth is insignificant. Insignificant. The pleasure that we're able to accrue here in the material world is insignificant compared to the heavenly planets. So in the heavenly planets, people are mostly in the mode of goodness. Mostly in the mode of goodness. They're very much affected, but they're not very much affected by the lower modes, passion and ignorance, but still a little bit there. And in the heavenly planets are not places where anyone can just barge in. Like so many people think, you know, even in today's society, in different religious traditions, you know, if I perform a certain function, then I will be assured of getting a position in the heavenly planets where I can get how many wives? How do they say? Virgins? 70. So, I mean, this is absolutely, you can't barge into the heavenly planets. You have to perform certain functions to even attain the heavenly planets. The example is there, like if we have a beautiful country like America, you can't just say today, oh, I think I'll go to America today. You know, you're restricted. You have to have visas to go to another place. We're struggling so much at the moment with visas here. You cannot just go to the heavenly planets. There has to be sacrifice. There has to be different processes that you have. It's interesting to note that in spite of all the comforts and luxuries available in the higher planetary systems, the Vedas don't encourage us to go there. And in fact, many times they discourage us. So the Vedic scriptures actually are saying, don't go. Don't even bother about it. Don't worry about it. It's just temporary. The heavenly planets, being part of the material creation, are temporary by nature and will be annihilated at a certain period of time. So they're not, you can never ever enjoy it. But we are individuals that want to enjoy forever. We want eternal bliss. It's not available in both the subterranean or the heavenly planets. Eventually, you have to die. You have to leave that facility. And the miseries of this birth planet, birth, death, disease, and old age, are there even in the heavenly planets and the subterranean planets. Abrahma, Bhuvana, Loka. You know, it's all places of misery. From the highest planet to the lowest planet, nothing but misery. So, Srimad Bhagavatam describes various incidents where the demigods are frequently attacked by powerful demons. And ensuing war may sometimes the demigods even lose. So even though you think there's the heavenly planets, you know, we're comfortably situated, even the demigods are in anxiety that the demons are going to attack them. So there's no peace at all. And so it's constant anxiety. So Srila Prabhupada compared this material world, the subterranean and the heavenly planets, every part of this material universe, as a prison house. It is just a prison house. We are all prisoners, trapped here. It's really interesting because, as you know, I do chaplaincy work also in the prison system. And I interviewed one boy recently, a really nice guy. He's the most gentle sort of person. He's in there under false pretenses. He's innocent. That's what he says. And he was so, because he's such a nice kid, he's such a nice man, they allow him to actually have more liberty. He can do the gardening around the fence. So he's got these huge big brick wall fences with barbed wire and stuff on the top. So he's actually allowed to do the gardening just right near the fence. You know? And he's so rapt that he can do that. He told me, oh, Bhakta Prabhu, I've been allowed to do the gardening near the fence, you know? And I can pick whatever flowers I want and I can, you know, nobody even checks me. So the guards have given him that much trust. And he said, yeah, but you're still in the prison. He said, yes, that's right. He said, but I'm also in the prison. I can go one step further outside of these walls, but I'm still trapped. I'm still a prisoner in this material world too. And you'll never escape this prison of material existence unless we surrender completely to the Supreme Lord. So, it's interesting, you know, like in that prison system, there's a level of severity. If you've really committed crimes, you're in solitary confinement. And believe me, you don't ever want to go into those places. It is the worst environment you could ever possibly see. So similarly, this universe acts like a prison house where the rebellious living entities are sent to reform themselves and to rectify their mistakes. We're all rebels. We are all rebels. We are all criminals. We all wanted something which is an ours. We wanted to enjoy for ourselves. All of us, each one of us. You may as well put a little number on the front here and wear striped uniforms, because we're all stuck in this prison, all of us together. On the part of, and that's dependent on our past activities. So, for extremely pious act, a person will be sent to the heavenly planet. So they get to do the gardening right up near Lord Shiva, and they can fiddle around up there, but still they're trapped. The sad thing is, however, is that even if someone becomes qualified to enter heaven, he will not be able to stay there permanently. So even if you're so relaxed, you know, you've got the ponds, you've got the swans, you've got the birds chirping, you've got the whole thing, as described in the previous verse, ultimately someone's going to come and say, sorry, Bhakta, time to go. You can't stay here, and that's it. So once accumulated pious credits are exhausted, he returns to the earth. He has to come back to you. So you did all these ashramated yogas and you've lived such a pious life and you've done aswaha with the idea of going to the heavenly planets to enjoy it. And ultimately, then you're forced to actually come back to this earth region. And you don't know where you're going to end up. It might be also a heavenly situation, but it could also be a hellish situation. And you've experienced all of these things. It's like a treadmill. You're going up, you're going, keep on going, or what do they compare it to? What do you call those things?
A Ferris wheel.
So you're going up, hey, we're in the heavenly planets, whoa, we're going back down to the hellish planets, over and over and over and over again. So Krishna explains this point in the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says, when they have thus enjoyed the heavenly sense pleasure, really enjoyed it, and the results of their pious activities are exhausted, they return to this mortal planet again. Thus, those who seek sense enjoyment by adhering to the principles of the three Vedas achieve only repeated birth and death. So Krishna therefore encourages us to come to his own abode, to come to Krishna Loka, to come to Krishna, the spiritual world which is full of eternality, knowledge and bliss, Satchit Ananda Vigraha, as opposed to the temporary material world which we find ourselves in. So, Bhagavad Gita again, 15.6, gives us a glimpse of the nature of his abode, where Krishna resides. And there it says, Nata Vashayate Suryo, Nashashakana Pavagaha, Yadgatvane Vivartante, Tadharma Paramam Mama. That supreme abode of mine is not illumined by the sun or the moon, or by celestial snakes with diamonds on their heads, nor by fire, nor by electricity. And those who reach it never return to this material world. So Krishna is giving us a guarantee. If we follow his direction, we don't have to come back to this material world. We will be free eternally. That's our real destiny. Our real destiny is to be eternally with Krishna. And it's interesting to note here that there's no need for sunlight or moonlight or electricity. If you take a little note from today's society, there's so much problem with energy, you know, lighting and electricity bills and so on. So here in this material world, we see how all-powerful time controls and gradually brings everything to the end. Time, color factor. In that atmosphere, the lower material modes of ignorance and passion are completely absent. So in the spiritual world, these lower modes are completely absent. The Supreme Lord is the chief leader, and all the inhabitants there are simply assisting him in his service. Krishna is the supreme leader. And the beautiful thing about the spiritual world is there's no competition. There's no competition. There's no one-upmanship. Everybody is humble. Everybody is striving just to serve Krishna in a completely conducive and aligned way. Everybody working together. So again, Srila Prabhupada writes in his purport to 9.21, instead of being elevated to the spiritual world, from which there is no longer any possibilities of coming down, one simply revolves in the cycle of birth and death on higher and lower planetary systems. One should better take to the spiritual world to enjoy an eternal life full of bliss and knowledge and never return to this miserable material existence. Human life, as opposed to animal life, is endowed with great responsibility. We have a responsibility. Rather than focus our energy on the lower modes, obtaining better facilities, getting better money, having a better house, having a beautiful garden, all these different things, and contemplating any sort of sex life. You know, like at the moment in politics, it's just so much about sex life. Whether it's homosexual, heterosexual, just forget about sex life. We need to focus and bring our attention to the permanent solution to get out of this material world. And the biggest obstacle to that is this desire to enjoy a sexual experience. And as you said, that's that old Ferris wheel. So a pure devotee of the Lord is never allured by such heavenly desires. A pure devotee doesn't see that at all. Becomes completely averse. Indeed, for a devotee engaged in full-time service of the Lord, the external situations don't matter a fig. If you're preaching to someone, it doesn't matter where you are. And every one of us has had that experience. If we're talking to someone about God consciousness, it's like all of a sudden we get a boost of energy. And we can go on and on and on and on and talk about Krishna consciousness. This is the wonderful thing. So we must be fully engaged. Somehow or another, if we can fully engage ourselves in devotional service, that is the best thing. You know, there's that old Christian adage, idle hands means a devil's workshop. So Prabhupada said that we have to be so fully engaged. He pushed his devotees to constantly engage in devotional service. I mean, we just had the wonderful visitation of Gurudas here, right? And before that, Shamsundara and Malati. Prabhupada pushed those devotees so much in a beautiful, subtle way. You know, like he was explaining to us how he was on the train and coming from, I think it was Mumbai or something, and that man was on the train that said, oh, I could help you set up a temple in Delhi. Did you hear that last time? He was in the train with Prabhupada, this is Gurudas, and Jamuna. And this man entered the train that said, oh, Prabhuji, you know, we can help you make a temple in Delhi. Now, they just arrived in India. They had no idea about India at all. And Prabhupada turned around to Gurudas and said, okay, you go with this man and set up a temple in Delhi. So it was like, what? It was like amazing, you know. So Prabhupada pushed his disciples because he knew that that was the panacea. That was the way to control our senses, to be fully engaged in Krishna's service. And, you know, we have comfort. There has to be comfort up to a point. But we don't need the comfort of the heavenly planets. We need to just be basically keeping body, mind and soul together. Just simple sort of thing. So, even here, you know, the comfort in our ashram, we shouldn't get, and this was what Aniruddha Prabhu was mentioning yesterday in class, we shouldn't get too comfortable in our ashrams. You know, whether it's the Brahmacharya ashram, because that can be pretty cushy. You're a lot more cushy than we were when we were Brahmacharyas or living in the ashram. I mean, we used to have a room at the top here. Can you remember? At the top here, there was, and we all laid together on one floor. You know, there was about 10 of us in a row sleeping. And, you know, there was cold showers out the back there. So in the Brahmacharya ashram, it's pretty cushy. But more importantly, the predominant group of devotees now are Grihasthas. Grihas. We got our Grihas and we want to make them as comfortable as possible. So we can stay in our Grihas, and like Aniruddha was saying, we can preach in our Grihas and say, oh, yes, we have our Bhakti Vriksha. I'm teaching so nicely. And that's great. That's really good. But in the same token, we should outreach as well. We should, and what Aniruddha was saying is very, very true. We should move outside of our comfort area. And he was relating the stories of going out on Harinam and how it's a blissful experience if you actually engage in it. And nowadays, especially, like he was saying, you know, nowadays when someone approaches, you may, from us old timers, think, oh my God, what's this guy going to do because of experience? I used to have this guy when I used to go out on Harinam on a Saturday night. And he would pick me up. I always used to be at the back of the Harinam party because myself and another devotee, because I was a little tall, and I mean, I'm tall, that's all. But somehow or another, they thought, okay, if we put the big guy at the back, he'll protect the women. Right? And they won't attack the women, because they used to attack the women. So we used to stand at the back, and there was this one guy. Every time I would go out on Harinam, he would spit on me. Mm-hmm. And I mean, he really, you know, like a big greenie, you know. Like, every time. And I just had to tolerate it. And other times, people would bash us and everything. But we never lost faith in it. And we would come back from Harinam, and we would be ecstatic. You know, sex life would be the last thing on your mind. You were just so enthralled with the kid. Did you see that guy? He was just wrapped, you know. And I tolerated the guy because he was spitting on me all the time. And I just kept chanting in his face, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. There was a bliss there. There was an ecstasy. And that's what you get when you move out of your comfort zone. You know, it's not comfortable going to the chaplain's seeing in the hospitals and seeing dying people. It's not comfortable going to a prison where you get searched and frisked and the guards are so, you know, incredibly overpowering. It's not comfortable. But the result of it is, once you've done your preaching, the ecstasy you feel, that real subtle satisfaction of presenting this knowledge of Krishna to someone else, it just overwhelms your whole consciousness. And all you can think about is, I want more of that. That surpasses any sort of material pleasure. Preaching surpasses any material pleasure. So you become really enthused. So Krishna says that you have to strive for it. There is pleasure of chanting and dancing. The Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. This is the other point that I wanted to make. It's stated in the Shastras, there is so much Prabhupada it says they are so much absorbed in chanting and dancing that there's no interest in sex. You know, I mean, we all experience that. No one is an island. You know, Simon and Garfunkel used to have that record, I am a rock, I am an island. No one is an island. Every one of us has experienced similar sort of things. But when you're fully engaged, when you're actually fully engaged in a Harinam Kirtan, where you just absorb yourself before the deities, there's not a question of sex life coming to your consciousness. So this is really wonderful. Prabhupada states that that is only one way. If you want to stop pleasure of sex, then you have to take this pleasure, this transcendental pleasure, and you'll forget everything about the other one. So you can't artificially practice it as well. This is the other thing. So we've seen that also in devotional service. You know, a person will put themselves up with, I'm not influenced by sexual desire at all. We've seen even big sannyasis and gurus fall down. To what? To sexual desire. So we have to be mindful. We have to see that it is a dangerous path that we're travelling on. So we can't be artificial in our devotional service as well. And the reason why I'm mentioning that is that sometimes due to concocted things, people concoct things. They want to make up things to sort of be a one-upmanship on someone else. Oh, I know so much better than you, and I will teach you. You know, like recently, I just heard a recent thing that came to my attention was this unauthorized and weird sort of things. One thing someone told me, Prabhu, is it okay? Someone told me that when I'm chanting on my Tulsi beads, if I have to go and pass water, and I come back from passing water, I can no longer chant on my Tulsi beads because I'm unclean. Hello. If you bathe, wash your hands, rinse your mouth, you're clean. You can chant on Tulsi. But somehow or other, this has come into, and I'm thinking, where the hell did that come from? Another one was, if I'm an uninitiated devotee, I can't wear Tulsi beads. Rubbish. Tulsi is for everyone. If one comes to Krishna consciousness and is in the mindset that I want to be a devotee, you're already a pure devotee. The rest of it is all just a matter of time. The initiation and everything, it's all just a matter of time. Prabhupada Krishna is already looking after you. And so Tulsi Devi will help you. Crazy stuff. The other things. And from the early days in Prabhupada's teaching, we can see this. If you go and see the film, Hare Krishna, the mantra, the movement, and the Swami who started it, you've got these things that where they say, oh, no, I don't want to be agitated. And so thereby, if there is a preaching program and there are women there, I'm not going. What sort of a nonsense is that? They're your brothers and sisters, for heaven's sake. You're all working together. You know, that means you've got a problem somewhere. Come and seek counselling. Seek someone out. You should just together. You can see Prabhupada was encouraging boys and girls to chant together. You know? I've even heard it said that if there are women going on Harinam, single women, the brahmacharis won't go. What sort of a nonsense is that? You're not coming into interface with kami women? You know, non-devotee women, and you're encouraging them to chant, your god sisters will help you to encourage those people to chant. So these sort of mental concoctions come into it when people are frustrated and deluded by different areas of sexual... When people have sexual desires, it manifests in so many different ways. One is by concocting different things, and that is basically saying, I know something better than you. Other people become incredibly morose, you know. They're always, you know, down in the dumps. You see them, you know. Devotional service is joyfully performed. If you're really getting a taste in your devotional service, you can't help but smile. You can't help but feel elated. You can't help but feel excited. You're going home back to Godhead, back to Krishna eternally. You know, there's no way. And the other one is that they're always in a bad mood. You know, someone that's frustrated by devotionals, by these pressures of the material energy. Don't talk to me! You know, or they snap at you or something, you know. There's a problem there. Address the problem. That's what I'm saying. We have to reveal our mind in confidence to someone that you trust. So these things are there. And I'm honest, they want to dominate. You have to do it the way I'm an older devotee, you do it the way I told you to do it. This is how you do it. All subtle sex desire. All subtle sex. It's just you have to become very normal in your devotional career. Be honest and normal. We're all affected by this thing. We'll all work it out together. We're a big family. Nothing surprises us. Believe me, nothing surprises any of us that have been in this movement for a while. And so you just control them. You just help the other person. And the way to really help them is that you completely absorb yourself in kirtan. If you're having problems, chant extra rounds. Do different things. Don't become, that's the other thing. You know, people that have that problem, they become really, really fanatic. You know? And forced devotional service. It's not like that. You just have to go in a normal way. But the main thing, as I was saying, is that you have to seek advice. Don't hold it into you by yourself. Don't just keep it to yourself. So, unless we advance in Krishna consciousness, unless we become accustomed to enjoying transcendental happiness through either chanting, through taking prasadam, through service, through deity worship. There's so many things where you can get so much joy, whether it's at home, worshipping the deity. I honestly can't think of another time that I'm more ecstatically joyful than when I'm dressing Sri Sri Gaudiya time. You know, people say, well, that's a mundane thing, you're just putting clothes. But I'm putting clothes on God. It's like a consciousness. I'm actually getting a chance to caress His lotus body. I'm caressing His lotus feet. You know, it's so, you know, and it's the last thing would be, oh gee, I'd really like to have sex now. It's like the last thing. So you have to engage yourself in chanting. Really chant. Don't just be blasé about your chanting. Seek the joy in chanting. It's there. All the scriptures advise it. Lord Chaitanya tells you it's there. So then seek it. Really look for it. You know, don't just give it lip service. You know, don't just think, oh, well, you know, I'm doing this as a chore. I have to chant my 16 rounds. And looking around or mulling around in the courtyard or, you know, looking at the birds and the trees or... No! Chanting means you really focus. Put that time for yourself aside. And it's not that you have to make a big show of it. You know, it's not that you have to go, hey, folks, that's also. It's just in your consciousness, you have to really just seek that enjoyment and pray to Krishna. I know this bliss is here in this chanting. Please give it to me, my Lord. Please let me hear this chanting. And participate in kirtan. You know, participate, really, and dance. Prabhupada was insistent on dance, even though big and older, it's a little bit more harder to dance. You know, dance as often as you like, but try it, you know. It's very, very important. And then presenting Krishna consciousness to others. That's the greatest bliss to be had. Book distribution. We've got the Sankirtan marathon at the moment. You know, there's so many devotees doing so much. How much bliss do you get when you actually give somebody a book that they actually, wow, they really, you know, I've attained this, I've done this. Krishna loves you so much, you know, this is the point of our whole existence, is that Krishna loves us so much. And that reciprocating love is the highest goal in human life, just to have that love of Krishna, whatever it takes. Be diligent in our sadhana, in our meditation on the holy name, spark the fire of devotional service in your consciousness. That is of the utmost. And seek out that eternal joy wherever you can in devotional service. Wherever you can, just seek it out. And that little blue boy, he loves you more than you can imagine. And he's waiting for you to just be with him forever, you know. One with him and also separate from him. Aveda Veda Chakra. Aveda. I'm so excited about this whole thing.
Take a breath.
Sir. So, is it?
Take a breath.
Yes. So you have to actually be so conscious that the Lord wants to embrace you and be with you. This is really where we're at. So please, I can only recommend this. Drop everything else and just be focused on that. Thank you very much for this. Any comments or questions? Yes, Lord, this.
What's that fine line, that the difference between knowing that you have to rectify yourself,
yep,
and having kind of a low self-esteem, oh, I'm so bad, I'm so funny, I need to do this, and I need to work so hard, because you can also go to, like you said, become fanatic, yep, overworking yourself because you need to achieve it, and you kind of think less of yourself, or and the difference with knowing that you're here in this material world to rectify yourself, and you must do the work. But I mean, how not to go to also that having self-esteem, thinking less of yourself, or overworking yourself because you feel like you're not good with yourself.
The first and foremost thing is that we have to remember that anything we do in this material world, Krishna only sees the positive things. He doesn't even want to look at all the negative things we've done. He only sees the positive things you do. So if you have a wonderful preaching session with a group of school kids, he's right there watching you. Good on you. Fantastic, Sophia, I love you for that. And you'll feel it in your heart. You do something else. If you chant really sincere rounds, and before you start chanting, you say, Krishna, I just want to chant for you, my Lord. And you chant. You'll feel it in your heart. Chaita Guru, Krishna within, Paramatma within, will actually say, Sophia, you chanted such good rounds. And you'll feel that joy. That's the joy. So you don't put yourself down. You just act normally. Now, if, say, for example, there is, and we're all addicted to sense gratification. We're drug addicts, all of us, in this room. All of us are drug addicts. It may not be to a particular intoxicant, but ultimately, as is pointed out in the scriptures here, we're all addicted to sex life, somehow or another, in grosser or subtler ways. If we can put that, if you keep it to yourself, you're going to have problems. We have to reveal our mind. Now, in the past, it was more difficult for us because there were no senior devotees, right? There weren't anybody that we could say, well, that person has been through a lot, you know, I'll go to him or her and ask for advice. You know, like I had one boy came to me some time ago and he was inquiring. He had a sexual problem and he couldn't stop it. And I said, okay, that's fine. Krishna doesn't see your little problem. He sees only the devotional service that you're doing. I said, try for a month to go without this little problem. I said, okay, I'll do that. And he did it. And it was a challenge. And he did it. Then I said, okay, now we'll go for 6 weeks. And he did it. And slowly he was progressing in his devotional service. And slowly he was getting more taste. Because Krishna within was saying, good boy, you're coming to me. You're not doing this thing for a selfish thing, you're actually coming to me. And slowly he progressed in his devotional service. But it was only through counseling and through revealing his mind and opening up that he was able to. Does that make sense to you? That is of the utmost importance. We and the senior devotees are here to help you. Not only just to advise you from a Shastric point of view and from scripture and teach you how to do this or that, but we're here to also help you so that you can open your mind. Like say, for example, it was interesting. When Gurudas was here recently, right? And he said himself, he's a counsellor. He's a counsellor, right? And he counsels people. He's trained to counsel people. So a certain, and he's a lovable, affable, approachable sort of person. As soon as he was here, about 5 or 6 people come, Prabhu, can you counsel me? They came up to him and they wanted counseling. So it's natural within us And we shouldn't be so proud as to think, I don't need counselling. We all need it. I'm doing a course at the moment where this is a course, it's called Ministerial Supervision through the Christian Church. And ministerial supervision is specifically to help ministers. I am the conduit for them. I am the facility for a person to just, just vomit on me. Just bring out all your stuff and let me just deal with it. And by the fact that they've expressed it, it's clear that for them. Everybody's got this problem, but nobody deals with it. So just be honest. Find someone that you can trust. Reveal your secrets to them. And guess what? The secrets will go away. And you'll start...
Do you recommend my room is paying for this class?
Oh, I don't know about that.
The main thing is, if we know that we are not body, which Lord Krishna says in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, if you are not body, then there is no question of sex. Ultimately, if you are not body, you have to survive during sex. So it doesn't mean sex.
Yeah, that's all I wanted to say, but we're totally immersed in that concept. Yeah. No, mate. I am this body. Yeah. Believe me, I am this body. I look at the mirror every morning, that's me.
I look after all your interests. Whatever you possess, I'll make sure you don't lose it. And whatever you lack, I'll give you.
Exactly. But there are processes by which you can access that.
Absolutely.
You have to have faith. Yes, you have to have faith. And you have to have trust and all those different qualities. But the most important thing is you have to have the desire to get out of this material world.
If you know that you are pure spiritual soul, you want to get out of it. You want to get it.
And that's the whole process of suffering.
When you're talking about dancing, Prabhupada was practically dancing also in the Marble Arch in London. The police was just after him. Stop this man. Stop this gentleman. Stop this old man. They were telling the devotees. But he was chanting. This is chanting and dancing so strongly that no
one... When you can be guaranteed that you're never ever going to suffer again for eternity, and live with Krishna in the most beautiful abode, with all your friends and everything, right, forever. Wouldn't you be joyful? Prabhupada realizes that. Prabhupada is that. He's completely pure. Does that make sense? It's like a wonderful experience, So I can only he was really inspiring me to do more in that area, and he did. And he said, it's just like we have to address these things and live in this world.
As you said, if we have faith in Bhagavad Gita, what Lord Krishna says, Bhagavad Gita is chanting is enough to get us out of the material world.
It can be. But Prabhupada said because we're so fallen in this condition, in this material, that's why Prabhupada instilled deity worship, chanting, prasadam distribution, and all those different things. And together we should do this together. Any other comments or questions at all? Yes, Prabhupada.
I'd like to share an incident that yesterday. Doing book distribution, not even know that. And this guy, took the book and, gave me $20 and went away. After 10 minutes, he came back to me. And I thought he might say, I want a refund. But he said, at least 10 times he said, thank you very much, and, can I just hug you for a minute? I mean, that was very, very ecstatic.
He didn't want to hug you. He wanted to hug Krishna with you.
Hare Krishna!
Unbelievable.
And I just went through the pictures and, I don't know what's in this book, but I...
You're an agent of Krishna. How did that feel?
Yes, it was ecstatic.
Did you feel more joy than he did? Isn't that wonderful?
Yes.
That's Krishna consciousness. That's wonderful. Thank you, Prabhu. And what's the first thing that you thought? I want more of that. I want some more of that.
Try much harder than that.
Okay, who's next? Haven't you heard that story about Jananda Swami? Did anybody see that on Facebook? Jananda Swami? He went out on book distribution for the marathon and everything in London. And And he wasn't doing well. He wasn't selling any books at all, you know. And then this one guy came up and he approached this guy and he presented the Bhagavad Gita and he said, "Oh, great, yes, I'll have that." But he said, "I don't have any money." The money from the ATM, withdrew quite a lot, gave him the money for the Bhagavad Gita, bought other books as well. And he said, "You wouldn't believe this, but this morning I'm actually on my way to a bookshop and my intention was to buy Bhagavad Gita."
Yeah.
And he sold it. So Krishna is behind everything. Krishna's playing with us. He's having fun with us. And these little interruptions, you know, like in marriage also, you know, if there's some sexual problem in marriage, it's not a big deal. We can work it out, but talk to people about it. Nothing is a big deal. Krishna only sees the beauty of your preaching. Whatever, you know, whatever we can do. He doesn't see any of this other stuff. Not interested. "Oh, here's my devotee, he's going to do that for me now." And ultimately it'll be so encompassing that you just go back home, back to devotee. Any other comments or questions? Yes, ma'am.
I hope I understood the question. She was mentioning that what if we overwork ourselves, doesn't mean that we need to overwork quantitatively, but qualitatively. Quantitatively, using only one sense, for our muscles and physical stuff, it doesn't mean much. Yeah, because all our five senses need to be reattached from material matter to spiritual matter. Because if we engage our bones and muscles, what's the use if we watch the mouse? So if we listen to music, and that's not overworking, it's just adding, saturating our senses, satisfying that with Krishna conscious objects, we are satisfied. And you don't have to worry about it. Naturally, we can watch Krishna's feet all the time. It says in Srimad Bhagavatam that intelligence gets strengthened by meditating on Krishna's lotus feet. All of us, when we chant, we can watch at Krishna's feet or we can watch at Krishna's form. And that will strengthen intelligence. Intelligence will control the mind.
Yeah, absolutely.
It goes automatically. It doesn't have to be only over-engaging with one sense and neglecting the others. And Krishna said the first thing in Bhagavad Gita, first step in spiritual realization is sense control. Because this is like a switch. Sense control switches us to matter or to light. When we engage our senses with the sense objects, that's connecting to the consciousness and modes. So it's up to us what we want, but it's not difficult if we engage all senses in Krishna consciousness. At least he gave us really good options.
Thank you, Mandy. That's really good. Any other comments or questions? We'll stop here. Srila Prabhupada ki jai!